Godspeed Institute with Carol Hollenbeck, Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck. The stream whose birth is in this source, I know, has a gigantic force in black of night. The eternal fountain is unseen in living bread that gives us being in black of night. She calls on all mankind to start to drink her water, though in dark, for black is night. O living fountain that I crave, in bread of life I see her flame in black of night. An excerpt from the poem The Fountain by St. John of the Cross. Joining us today is Ann Scott, founding director of Dreamweather Foundation, which focuses on bringing the feminine principle back into everyday life by cultivating and respecting the relationship women have to themselves and to each other, so that women trust and follow the innate wisdom that they have for healing, leading, and social transformation. She has been developing and leading workshops and retreats for women for over 20 years in the United States and other countries. From her experience, Anne has come to understand that women and the feminine way are critical for the health and well-being of all life, families, communities, societies, and the earth. Anne, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Kara. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
Why don't we begin first with a glimpse? Would you please share a moment or prayer or story that you consider a special cameo of meaning on your journey?
I would say that there was an experience that I had when I was attending a women's conference. It was bringing together women from many different spiritual traditions and cultural backgrounds from all over the world. And in any conference, there's always a need for people to present themselves and to speak and to find out who each other is. And so the first morning after I arrived, I sat down at a table at breakfast, and there were many women coming into the room, women wearing different nationality clothing, and a woman sat next to me, and she introduced herself, and I found out that she was a woman who is a Mayan grandmother who works with the United Religions. And we chatted just for a couple of minutes, and then she looked at me, she turned and looked at me, and she said, "Who are you?" And my immediate response was to tell her about what I do, and that was that I founded a nonprofit organization, that I work with women, and I said a few more sentences, but I could tell that that's not what she asked me. And so she looked at me very, very carefully, and she said, "No, that's not what I asked. Who are you?" And in order to respect her question, because I could feel it came from a very deep place, I answered her with what came to me in that moment. It certainly didn't come from my thinking mind. And what I said to her was that I am a woman who has suffered in her life, and in that suffering found a light.
Well, that's a very different answer, isn't it?
It was a very different answer, and one that I normally would not say to someone, particularly in the first 2 minutes of meeting them. And she looked at me again, and she said, "You need to stand with that knowledge. You can't be shy. You can't be humble. And she meant it in the terms of hiding something. She said, you need to stand up with that. And then our conversation was pretty much over. And I didn't see her for the rest of the conference. And I knew that she really affirmed, she gave me a gift. And I think that's perhaps one of the meaningful experiences that I had after many years, where something very hidden was coming into light. And for a woman to be able to stand with that and not hide that, particularly in these times when we need to share what we know and who we are. So I'd say that was really a stamp in my life. Not what do you do, but who are you?
Exactly. And that's a great beginning place for us today as well, because I believe culturally, and this isn't just women, but men as well, we have come to answer who are you with what we do, with tasks. And I think it's common culturally in the West. We are our job titles or our resumes. We explain our awards when someone asks who we are.
Oh, yeah.
And it's rather systemic. It seems to be starting in the public schools or, you know, in with school children and then, you know, on through adulthood. But how has this affected us? And in particular, how has it affected women?
I think it's had a very profound effect on each of us if we were raised in this culture. It touches you in, and when I say you, I mean us, it touches the very depths of the very core of our being, because there's no place for it in that kind of question. What do you do? And so, of course, we want to share maybe our achievements or our interests, our position in work, but there's a whole level that gets hidden, and so I think we identify so strongly with what we do that if that gets taken away, if for instance we lose a job or if we lose a particular identity that we had, people become seriously ill or depressed or they don't know how to be, and so I think for women it's had a very undermining effect on her value as and worth as a human being. And I think that goes for everyone, but women in particular, because her being is such an important part of who she is. It's her nature.
The part that we suppress then, or the part that's forgotten, is the true self then, the true essence of who we are, our being. And so that would, I imagine, touch on life force and energy and all kinds of different types of flows that get stuck or stopped, I imagine.
Yes, that is what happens. And we have such a longing for that place. We have such a craving for something real. And so if there's no recognition of it, for many, many women, they don't know what to do with that part of themselves, and they don't think it exists.
And it may be the larger part of themselves.
Yes.
Now, how does Dream Weather address this in your work?
Well, from the very beginning, I knew that my interest and my dedication was to help women recover that very real place within themselves, that sacredness, that their true nature. And that was something that was with me in the first dream that I ever had about the direction of my work. And
can you share some of that with us, that the organization began with a dream?
Yes, it did.
Please.
I remember many years ago, I was, I knew that I was to work with women. I had always worked with women, in fact, in Even when I was a journalist, I was always interviewing women when I could. And but I was camping one night, and I really needed to know more about the direction of my work and where my focus would be. And so I remember getting out of the tent, and there was a full moon that night, and I looked at the moon, and I just inwardly asked for some illumination of what direction I should go in. And I stood there for a while, and it was really a prayer. And then nothing happened, of course. Maybe I thought there'd be some kind of instant clarity, but it didn't happen. And so I went back into my tent and fell asleep. But that's when I had this dream about the future of the work that I would be doing with Dreamweather. And in the dream, I saw the earth, and it was very, very wounded. There were places. It was a beautiful, beautiful earth. But then when I looked more closely, I could see areas that were red and inflamed, and I knew that that's where there was violence or war, and the surface of the earth was really hurting and really suffering. And then my attention went to the right, and then I suddenly saw the full moon. And what was so extraordinary was that the full moon was shining light onto these inflamed places on the earth, like sunlight, but it was very soft and a different quality, very diffuse. And it streamed onto the surface of the earth. And I heard these words, "Wherever the feminine touches, there is healing." And then I knew that my attention would be on the feminine, to both understand that more consciously for myself and to help other women to understand it and then connect with it and reclaim it.
Thank you so much, Anne, for that answer. And when we talk about the feminine, we may want to mention that we're not only speaking of women or just women's spirituality, but the feminine in us all.
Exactly.
Just as we're both male and female in terms of our our hormones, we also have both components to our spirituality. And I imagine as of late, a lot of it of the feminine has been subdued or negotiated somehow or suppressed.
Yes.
And that has an effect on us in terms of balance.
That has certainly affected everyone, men and women alike. And I do feel that while there's a work that I know women are drawn to and really feel compelled to understand how they can contribute in a feminine way to life, that men also have this deep underlying yearning, to connect with the feminine in themselves. And so, yes, we have to be very aware that this is an awareness. This is a quality. The feminine aspects are in all of us, and we need them.
Go ahead.
No, we need them. All of us need that.
I was reflecting this week on your work and material, and I was thinking about feminine spirituality or the essence of womanhood. And I know that for myself, anyway, that part of it, as you mentioned motherhood before, part of it is nurturing, part of it is softer, like that moonlight. But there's also the other side of womanhood also, which is that mother bear, the righteous rage and protection, and there are many aspects to the feminine as well. I think sometimes we tend to almost stereotype these things as though one kind of energy is penetrating and the other is sort of submissive, but it's not always that way.
No,
and I imagine your work gets into that as part of the reclaiming.
There's many aspects of the feminine, and I wrote a book a number of years ago called Serving Fire, which had more to do with the nurturing aspects excuse me, and I wanted to explore how we ate and how the feminine deeply nourishes our lives and the people around us. But then, shortly after writing this book, I had a dream, and in the dream, there was a voice, or a person speaking, but I didn't know who they were, and they said, "Do you know what the feminine is?" And so I answered, I didn't answer, actually, and before I could answer, this person answered and said, "The feminine is not only the aspect of serving fire, which was the nurturing quality in my book. The feminine is also that raw, terrifying chaos out of which everything new is born." Mm. And so I certainly had to experience that in my life of times when there were energies and powers that I had to learn and understand and become more conscious of, so that these aspects of the feminine could be used in service rather than in a destructive way.
Yes, yes. Now, you mentioned before some of your background. You mentioned being a journalist.
Yes.
You have a colorful and diverse journey.
Thank you.
And I believe you have some formative spiritual experiences along the way, including perhaps a Buddhist chef.
Yes.
Could you share a little bit of how your journey formed?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Many years ago, in my 20s, I was living in Hong Kong and working as a journalist for different newspapers and magazines. And I was able to find a job, a freelance work, where I would be going to China for 2 weeks on one of the first tour trips with foreigners going into China. And I was very excited about it. And so I was to write about what happened on this trip and to take photographs of this tour group. And so it was quite interesting, because I asked for vegetarian food, although I'm not a vegetarian, but I didn't particularly want to eat the large quantities of meat that were served in China, because they felt that's what Westerners loved. And so I was being given rice and peanuts and cabbage at every hotel, because somehow they thought that's what I ate. And but I didn't mind, because I was so happy to be in China. It was such an amazing experience for me. But after about nearly 2 weeks of this, we were in a small inn, and I'd grown accustomed to this this same meal. But for some reason, at dinner time, everyone else was being fed and their dishes were brought out, but there was nothing for me, and I thought maybe they forgot or they didn't know how to cook vegetarian food.
Mm.
So I was just about to grab some rice on the table that had been served to the other people, and then the inn chef or the cook came out into the room and walked toward me with a tray, and he presented me with about a dozen of the most beautiful Chinese vegetarian dishes that I'd ever seen. And he put the food in front of me, and then he bowed, and I was really taken aback. I was very startled. And he started explaining to me that he hasn't been able to cook vegetarian food for many years, because he used to be a cook in a Buddhist monastery, but they were closed down by the government.
Mm.
And so he honored me. Perhaps he thought I was Buddhist, I don't know. But he bowed to me again, and he had such devotion and such reverence. And then he left, and something happened in that experience. No one had ever bowed to me in my life.
Hmm.
And I was disconcerted by it. And I ate a little bit and shared the rest with everyone in the room, who also was amazed by that, by the food. But that night something happened, and I went to sleep. And as I was falling to sleep, I saw this Buddhist cook bowing before me. And it was a disturbing feeling because it was inside me, it wasn't outside. And then he kept doing this. I say he, the image of like a movie. I kept seeing this scene over and over. And each time something happened to my heart and it started opening and opening. And I found myself throughout the night in an really an altered state of sometimes crying and sometimes feeling this incredible sweetness that cut through all my defenses and all my protection that I had carefully laid over my heart over the years. And the next morning, because it was such an experience beyond the mind, I had absolutely no idea what to do with it. And in a way, my mind thought I was a little crazy. And so I just pushed it away. I pushed this memory away for 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
It seemed so healing, though.
It was incredibly healing, but I had no context for this kind of love. I had no context. I hadn't had that kind of experience in my life, nor did I have the people around me to maybe reflect what this might be. So it became like a hidden secret. And perhaps I was afraid of it.
Mm.
It was so beyond my mind. So it really wasn't until 10 years later that I had another experience of love again in the night. And this time I was more open and receptive. And I saw that there was this theme of recognition. Really, the gift that this Buddhist cook gave me was recognizing my divine nature, bowing to that. And that woke up. And so...
That's lovely. And you know what occurs to me, too, hearing the story, is that not only was he honoring the divine feminine in you, but he was also honoring it in himself.
Yes.
When he nurtured you that way.
Yes.
And perhaps, you know, such a simple gesture, in a way can be both heartbreaking.
Yes.
And then the heart can be stitched back together again.
Yes.
In a different way. But yeah, that's wonderful how it actually took time and it sort of had to be, you know, in a way sat on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're coming to about, halfway through the program now. And I would like to, we're just going to take a break here and come back to a whole lot more conversation with Ann Scott. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation on dreams, healing, and oneness with Ann Scott of Dreamweather Foundation. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with one of our favorite theologians here around the Godspeed Institute, Johnny Cash. Stay with us.
How many times have you heard someone say, if I had his money, I could do things my way? But little they know that it's so hard to find one rich man in ten with a satisfied mind. Once I was winning in fortune and fame, everything that I dreamed for, to get a start in life's game. Then suddenly it happened, I lost every dime. But I'm richer by far, with a satisfied mind. Money can't buy back your youth when you're old, or a friend when you're lonely, or a love that's grown cold. The wealthiest person is a pauper at times, compared to the man with a satisfied mind. When life has ended and my time has run out, my friends and my loved ones believe there's no doubt. But there's one thing for certain, when it comes my time, I'll leave this old world with a satisfied mind.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're talking about dreams, healing, and oneness with Ann Scott of Dreamweather Foundation. Ann, in this part of the program, I would like to focus more on dreams themselves, as well also about your journey and how you came to know Sufism. Which would you like to begin with?
Perhaps the understanding of how I came to Sufism, because that could lead to the dreams.
There we go.
All right.
So how did, now I don't know what your childhood faith you grew up with, if any. Perhaps we can start there.
Well, very briefly, I lived in many countries around the world. When I was growing up, my family moved many times. But I did get a period of time in California and in Hawaii. And there I was... my mother had taken me to the Episcopal Church. And so I had a few years, maybe 5 or 6 years, of attending the church, the Episcopalian church. But then when we moved to Europe, that ended. And I feel that that's when my real spiritual training began, or perspective, because there I was able to... go to many of the cathedrals at a very young age, and to be in Chartres Cathedral, I was touched by something that I could never forget. It was just really steeped in a certain quality of sacredness that I had not experienced before in my childhood.
And I'm right there with you about cathedrals. Was there anything in particular that touched you about the one at Chartres in France, I imagine?
I remember several aspects of it. I was really very young. I was 12 or 13. I remember the stone floors, and I remember seeing how smooth they were and worn they were, and I knew that people for centuries had been walking, kneeling, and praying on them.
Mm.
And that was something that I never forgot. And the other aspect was the stillness, the silence, and the quality of light coming through the stained glass windows. And so there was always this, for me, I was always aware of the light in darkness. I was always aware of, I guess very much like that dream of mine, very much of the light streaming through into the darkness, and how we can see it in that framework. So that's what I remember of Chartres, and also that it touched me. It reminded me of something, not that consciously, but reminded my heart of who I am.
Mm. That's lovely. Now then, how did you come to know Sufism along the journey?
Well, I'd actually never heard of Sufism until my late 30s. And I had a need. I was really, really suffering in my life at that time, and there was a part of me that needed to know who, why I was here, what my life was about, and so the first experience was in a very simple book that someone gave me, and I read that book without sleeping that night. I just read it until the end, and then I remember a great discovery, a great revelation that my life, with its mistakes, with its failures, with everything, was part of a journey to God, and I never knew that before. And I remember thinking that it was like I'd been standing on one leg my whole life, and suddenly I had the other one, and I could be here in a completely different way. So it touched my heart. I didn't know if the book was fiction or not. Didn't even know. And yet this calling in my heart to understand love and to understand how to live my own devotion. It was really within a matter of a year or two that I heard a Sufi teacher speak, and it was very ordinary and it was very simple.
Extraordinary.
I know. And yet, and I remember leaving this small house where I heard him speak, a living room in a house, and I remember seeing light. I think for the first time, seeing light around someone, and I walked out in wonder, and there was a gentleman next to me, and he goes, "That wasn't any big deal, was it?" and I thought, everyone sees differently.
Yeah.
Everyone sees what they need and what they're ready for. And so for me, that night I had a dream, and that's when I knew that this very simple path that spoke about love was in my heart. So
thank you. That's so lovely. Now you had another dream. So let's talk about dreams then. They obviously play a very important role in your life and work. And if you could, you know, share, because we all have dreams, but obviously different relationships with them, perhaps. What are dreams to you, and how do they work within women in particular?
Dreams to me are generally gifts that come from the divine, or that come from a very deep place within us, or that are connected to our soul. There's many types of dreams, but I'm speaking about the ones that we remember, the ones that we wake up in the middle of the night and think, what was that? To say what is a dream, I think I almost have to say that what is a dream to us? In other words, when we have a dream that has this numinous quality or very powerful quality that wakes us up, or that has a certain energy that we didn't even know existed, that there is something, there's some great mystery that comes from our depths. It's like a very deep, deep, deep river. And that's why I was so touched by what you read with St. John of the Cross. In this darkness, that this deep river, this that we normally don't have access to, a more sacred part of us, or a part that's more connected to our wisdom, our natural wisdom. And so that's what I feel. I don't think I can say what a dream is. I can say how it works, but it's really quite a mystery to me. I just know that from the very beginning of my dreaming awareness, which really didn't start happening till my late 30s, that I trusted them implicitly. I knew that they could guide me, and that they could show me out of a hard place, or through a hard place, to a kind of light on the other side.
It's interesting, when we talk about the mystical, for example, Sufism, is the mystical tradition of Islam.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the Christian tradition, of course, the mystics like John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, and particularly his poetry, is also of the mystical and embrace. One of the reasons it's so revered is because of the language that embraces both the male and female qualities of God in these very rich images and terms that makes his poetry so powerful right through the centuries and so enduring. So I find that the mystical traditions of the faiths tend to rise up and connect, you know, beyond all the faiths into a kind of common language or
Absolutely.
Common imagery, if you will.
Well, this is what was so interesting to me. I didn't identify myself as being a Christian. However, when I started having dreams and met a Sufi teacher, the language of my dreams were Christian, and they often still are. And using the language of the Christ, for instance, and I was very surprised. And so this commonality of humankind, of every religion, is this deep fountain of wisdom and of love, this mystical understanding of God or the divine. And for me, the dreams themselves help me to accept that part of myself, to recognize that was actually a very it was my purpose in being here.
Now, what is the power of dream work, and is this something, this awareness, something that can be practiced?
Oh, absolutely.
Please share about that.
Most everyone dreams. Some people don't remember their dreams, but something happens when we start recalling them. We write them down. We think about them, reflect on them, share it with someone that may have an understanding of dreams, and it's like a deep communication that goes on within ourselves, and it opens and it reveals reveals hidden secrets of who we are and what our life is about, and it's not always beautiful.
Right.
Sometimes there's this great darkness that it reveals, but as you say, it's all of it. It's this light that shines on all aspects of ourselves, so that they can be healed and transformed, and not just for us, but it connects us to our relationship to all of life. And so, in a very simple way, we just start remembering them and valuing them. And one of the most common themes that I hear in all the groups that I've spoken to and all the women that I've whose dreams I've heard, in the beginning, and sometimes not just in the beginning, a woman will say that I had a fragment of a dream, but it doesn't mean anything. And I hear this so many times.
Just discounting it, huh?
It's always, to me, it's the flag. Oh, there's something really interesting in this fragment. And so what happens is just so it's so revealing of our culture that the rational mind gets a hold of it and looks at it and dismisses it before we've had a way of even listening or holding it. And so, not to even dismiss the images, the symbols that come, they often contain something so rich and so important for us. So it's really a very practical way of learning to listen, because then it helps us to listen to life and to the people around us. And I hear people's dreams in so many different situations. Sometimes in a store when I'm buying something and I remember once recently, and I was about to give a talk, and I was a little distracted, and the young man said, you know, what are you doing today? And I said, I'm giving a talk. That's why I'm not so aware of getting the right milk or something like that. And so he said, I told him what it was about because he asked, and he said, oh, I had that dream a couple of nights ago. Can I tell you? And so people have a connection to the inner world, but they don't have a way to value it.
Well, yeah, and again, I'll point to the culture in the West in particular, which is this is more intuitive, esoteric knowledge that's really valuable because it's timeless and informative, and but it's not the focus of our the general lifestyle. It just isn't. I want to share with you. I've only had one kind of recurring dream in my life. And I call them the upper room dreams because I generally have to climb up somewhere to get to this place that's special. And the first time I went, this was during a time of transformation for me where I was studying theology. And the first time I went to the upper room, it was like the inside of Genie's bottle. You know, it was all cushy and colorful with big pillows everywhere. And it was just so nice and yummy. And then the next time I had the upper room dream, and I actually had the conscious thought as it was starting, oh, good, I'm having one of these dreams again, it was completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a gutted New York building, completely broken in the rain, rain coming right down through everything. There was caution tape. I wasn't even allowed in the space. And there was a construction crew there. And I was just watching it going, oh, my gosh. You know, what happened? And and this, of course, in progress, a work in progress. And then I had a, another visit after that in which I climbed up to what was the, I guess, remade upper room, which was now an enormous crystal cathedral. And I always took that to mean a reflection of something changing inside me during that time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if these are messages and such, and I guess that's the kind of, extended intensive focus you might be offering at in retreats and workshops, which is what do these things mean?
Mm-hmm.
And how do they impact our life, or how do they work as guides for us, or, how are dreams related to wisdom and compassion through this connection with the feminine? So in your work, then, who do you work with, and how?
I work with women from many different walks of life. Women in universities or colleges, women who come to workshops or retreats, and also women who are in newly homeless women who are in shelters, women in transition. The work is fairly similar in that I listen and what happens when you listen to someone really deeply, they feel heard, they feel that part of themselves, if they're sharing a dream, was received. And something alchemical takes place that allows that depth to come forward. And it might have been hidden in them, it might have been inaccessible, but in even sharing the dream and listening in that way, and we've really forgotten this incredibly powerful quality of the feminine, which has to do with listening. It's very dynamic. And that then the woman can understand this part of her that maybe she didn't even recognize before, that has to do with her wholeness or the place in her that never was touched, the pure place. And so by asking questions and asking how the dream might feel, it's like an opening, like a flower opening. There's layers and layers, there's depths that can be revealed. And it's not, you know, you say esoteric, but actually what I've found is that this wisdom is really simple. It's really natural to women. And it really has to do with everyday life, as well as that very private inner journey. And it also has to do with our relationship to the world and to the earth. It's as if we go into the depths of ourselves, and then we can reconnect with everything. And so a dream can do that, way beyond what our mind even could imagine. So, for instance, in your dream, it reminded me of someone else's dream of upstairs in the house. And it was pouring down rain. And this woman was desperately in her dream duct taping and trying to keep the rain out and patching up the holes, and she couldn't. She would patch this one up and it would come to another place in the ceiling. And I understood that as grace, that the rain was grace. And that sometimes we don't know how to receive it.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes that's when we need it most.
Yes, and so,
you know,
so the dream can open us to a different way of being in a very, you know, very ordinary situation in our daily lives that brings in this other quality of grace or of compassion.
Well, that's something I was sharing a little while ago with someone about a very stubborn houseplant. I noticed, you know, the drier the soil, and the more it needed water, the more the water just sat on top. And I remember looking at the plant going, "Come on, you need this, drink." You know, and finally it was almost like with a sigh that it surrendered and the water went down into the soil. You know,
beautiful.
Sometimes the very thing we need, we're so, you know, busy bolstering ourselves. We don't let it in. But when you talk about meeting with the homeless and others, because we do, you know, on the program, we talk about all kinds of things and from the spiritual point of view, including, you know, even the state of the economy, the Occupy, you know, movement. When you meet with people like this, do you sense the fear? Is there a greater fear happening in terms of the dreams or the dream work about life? Or are you reaching for a different kind of connection?
In the shelters?
In the dream work with this very diverse group of people, including the homeless in the shelters. Is there a heightened experience of fear?
No, actually, I don't hear the fear so much. It's not like I filter these out, the dreams out. I just ask what's present or what women want to bring to a circle. I don't hear fear. What I hear more of is sometimes confusion. But I also hear about new life, and it may seem strange at this time, but I will hear in times of devastation in certain people's lives, I will hear a dream of a green plant or a bud or a tree that is nearly dead, but the woman is being told to tend it. Really, to me, it's like a very deep and natural wisdom about how to care for life. And so it seems almost more practical than it does about fear, which would constrict us and turn us away from life. So that's a really interesting question, because I don't hear that much about the fear.
That is interesting.
Even among women who have lost everything.
Yeah. Well, I think it's at the points of our devastation that we're actually opening up.
Yes.
You know, That quote came back to me. I think it was perhaps Oscar Wilde. You know, we're all of us in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. At some point, we look up.
Yeah.
I love the dreams you capture briefly on your website.
Mm-hmm.
What do you recommend that folks do who may not be able to get to a retreat? Should we just start to begin keeping a dream journal, or how would we begin to practice awareness?
I would definitely keep a notebook by your bed, and I would begin the practice of writing down a dream, even if it's in the middle of the night, because more often than not, it will be forgotten in the next morning. And so writing it down is like a yes. It's a dream knows when it's being welcomed. And in the same way, it's like welcoming our deeper knowledge or our deeper wisdom. And so we write it down and then maybe read a book, or maybe share it with someone, or they can even email me a dream. It's just important to share something if it has a very strong strong impression on you, and I absolutely trust that dreams will draw the people or the circumstances or the book that you'll need to understand it. Sometimes you just have to hold it. And it might be something really ordinary. It might be driving down the freeway and seeing a bumper sticker that will remind you of the dream and maybe have something to do with the dream. But I think that's the first step. And I don't know if you know that I wrote a book on dreams. It's very simple, Women, Wisdom, and Dreams.
Yes.
But it's something that, just by honoring the dream, I think the dreams actually begin to start flowing more and we remember more.
And as we're able to capture it, we can start to string it together perhaps over time.
Yes.
However long it takes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, Anne, as we come to the end of the program, I wanted to let listeners know that all your information and website info, et cetera, and mm-hmm. all your links will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. Mm-hmm. But if you can just let us know that email address now, we'll just let that go out right now.
It's info@dreamweather.org.
info@dreamweather.org.
Yes.
Anne Scott, I'd love to thank you so much for being on the program. It's been a very meaningful hour and engaging discussion. I hope perhaps we can speak again in the future.
Thank you. I would love to do that, Karen. I really enjoyed being with you.
Thank you. And stay in touch. Let us know when your retreats and workshops are coming up, and we'll keep everyone posted.
Oh, I will do that. Thank you so much, Kara.
Thank you.
All right.
Now, before we wrap up this week's program, we were talking about the practical aspects of spirituality and mentioning some challenges, including the homeless today and other economic aspects of our culture and every culture. And I just wanted to send along some thoughts here about money. Which is just another form of energy. When we're young, our relationship with money is quite indirect, as our parents provide for needs and desires. As we get older and become increasingly self-sufficient, we engage directly with money and learn its impact on our life. It is usually then that the question arises in us about money in relationship to happiness, a question that is at its core one of spirituality. Like anything in life, body, soul, love, sunlight, food, money is energy. It can be used to get by, to build, to bring together, or too often to divide. The spiritual sticking point is not the actual currency, but our relationship with money, how we perceive it, seek it, hoard it, utilize it, or abuse it. Our financial health, like our physical and emotional health, must be in line with our beliefs if we're to enjoy peace of mind. Financial health is not only about prosperity and security. Ultimately, it's about right relationships, maturity, and honesty. For example, avoid debt. Over time, debt can trap a person in a cycle of frustration and shame, cutting into self-esteem so that a person's eyes are taken off the true prizes of life, supporting a family, realizing aspirations, and giving charitably. Remember that money is a tool in this world, even though it's a powerful one. It does not in itself bring happiness or fulfillment or peace. That will come from the choices you make in life, the fruit of your experiences, and the lessons you are able to learn. The mark of success is in your learning. That will make you rich. Thank you for joining us on the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always love to hear from you. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. Join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.